Morning, Oregon. I'm Finn J.D. John, FJ at offbeatoregon.com, and this is the Daily Offbeat Oregon History Podcast. It's Monday, so this is an archive show, first published as a newspaper column sometime in the last 10 years. Thanks for downloading, and I hope you enjoy the show. This story was first published on July 10th of 2016, under the headline, Who Had the Motive to Frame an Innocent Man? Everyone did. Here we go. In the cold light of history, the conviction and execution of Robert E. Lee Folks was almost certainly a railroad job, and it's highly likely that the real murderer of the lovely young Martha Brinson James was none other than the prosecution's star witness, Marine Corps Private Harold Wilson. As outlined in last week's column, it was Wilson's conflicting testimony, along with an unsigned confession likely beaten out of Folks by the Los Angeles Police Department and aided by the hostility of the jury and some rabble-rousing references to Folks as a zoot suitor in local newspapers, that sent the cosmopolitan young black man to the gas chamber. But why? Why would all the authority figures, from the railroad's house detective all the way up to Governor Earl Snell and maybe even higher, have acted in this way to hang a man they should have at least suspected was innocent of the crime? We can't really know the answer to that question, but if you consider the consequences that might have resulted from Wilson being publicly accused of this crime, it begins to make a lot more sense, especially in the context of an America in its darkest wartime hour. Let's start with the Southern Pacific Railroad. Guyer, in his book, makes an excellent case for the railroad having had a strong incentive to pin this killing on Folks. To the railroad, Folks was a somewhat dangerous man, an intelligent, articulate, well-connected black man who also happened to be a prominent member of a union that the railroad really wanted to break. Sending him up the river in the face of plenty of evidence of his innocence would send a powerful message to members of that union that it could not protect them. The union, that is, not the railroad. Then there are Oregon law enforcement agencies. The various law enforcement agencies charged with investigating this crime shared a very strong incentive to pin it on Folks rather than trying to indict Wilson for it. The reason was simple: to save face. There's no ambiguity here. They all bungled it badly. First, they didn't secure the crime scene. The train stopped at several stations with people freely allowed on and off before law enforcement people met up with it at Eugene to start the investigation. And when the agencies did finally get involved, they did it like a pack of paparazzi at the Oscars. There was Lane County Sheriff's Office, the Eugene Police Department, the Oregon State Police, the railroad's own in-house detective bureau, and once they got to the scene, the Linn County Sheriff's Office. Federal investigators from the U.S. Navy and the FBI soon weighed in. Witnesses were interviewed and re-interviewed, all in a big room so that they could hear each other. Naturally, their stories started to influence one another. Evidence was mishandled, stepped in, tracked around, and then cleaned up. And then, to top it all off, the railroad company parked the murder car on a spur line right next to the biggest USO facility in the region for a week, where it and any lingering uncompromised evidence received hundreds of visits from curious soldiers and sailors. A day or two later, the story was in the headlines nationwide, and federal law enforcement officials were making some very nasty remarks about evidence handling and crime investigating skills out in Oregon. A nationwide public relations disaster was in the offing. That much we know, as a matter of public record. Here's the speculative part of the scenario. The theory goes a little like this. Oregon authorities can see it's important to find somebody to pin this on, and fast, so that they can get back to not being a national laughingstock. But the most likely suspect, Wilson, has had a week in which to get his story straight. And because he's white and a military man, any jury will choke on the reasonable doubt introduced by their failure to secure the crime scene. Prosecuting him will only result in a high-profile acquittal that will showcase every detail of their incompetence and make them look even dumber. What's needed is a fall guy to pin it on. And nobody's more vulnerable to that sort of, call it judicial lynching, in 1943 America than one of the train's African-American crew members. A provincial jury made up of white people whose familiarity with black folks consists entirely of racist pulp mag stories about savage black rapists attacking pure white maidens will be far more likely to convict a black man than a white one, in absence of any real evidence of guilt. And such a fall guy just happens to be handy. So, with a little help from LAPD's jailhouse interrogation squad, they fabricate what they need. So, is this what happened? We can't really know for sure, but it sure seems very likely. The motive was certainly there. But the agency with the most compelling motivation to crucify folks was the United States War Department. Here's why. Imagine, for a moment, that you are an 18-year-old single woman, and it's early 1943, close to the darkest hour of the war. You're doing your best to be brave, and everyone must make sacrifices, so you're riding trains unchaperoned, and you're walking to your home front manufacturing job in the dark by yourself. But it's okay because you feel safe with all the uniformed soldiers and sailors around. Strong and brave and confident, they represent security to you, and you feel sure that if you should ever need anything, you could ask one of them to help you out. Then, suddenly, you hear a story from the West Coast. A U.S. Marine has been accused of having raped and murdered a pretty girl, just like you, in a Pullman sleeper car, just like the ones you're riding in regularly all by yourself on long war-related trips. Suddenly, you're looking at those soldiers and sailors in a completely new way. As potential threats rather than as sources of comfort. And every other pretty woman in the country is doing the same. They're avoiding rail travel. When forced to take an overnight train, they're arriving at their destinations exhausted and unrested. Worse yet, other low-quality men in uniform are starting to jump on this criminal bandwagon. There's another assault, and another. Soon women are refusing to travel alone on rail cars and wondering if they're safe on the streets. Morale, at this most key point in the war effort, collapses. And it all could have been avoided if that crime that touched it all off had been committed not by a uniformed soldier, but by, say, an African-American railroad cook. That would make it so much more of a random sort of threat. I mean, a black cook climbing into a Pullman booth with a passenger would be so unusual that people would view it as a freak incident. Looked at this way, railroading folks was almost a patriotic duty, and his subsequent execution wasn't much different from a death on a battlefield. It may even have saved lives. But the price of that non-outcome was a grave injustice. An innocent man killed, and a guilty one not only set free, but released from the duty assignment that would have likely cost him his life. And in fact, out of all the military personnel in that murder car on the night Martha James was killed, the only one who survived the war was the one who, if our theory is correct, should have taken Folk's place in the gas chamber, Private Harold Wilson. Key sources in this story have included works by Max G. Geyer, Neil Barker, and the Oregon Historical Quarterly. Well, that's our show for today. Thanks again for listening. This podcast is part of Offbeat Oregon History, a public history resource for the state we love. What you've been listening to is one of more than 500 stories originally created and published in newspaper columns in first-run syndication between 2008 and today. You can read them all at offbeatoregon.com. Offbeat Oregon is a division of Pulp Lit Productions, pulp-lit.com, which is a boutique publishing house owned and operated by yours truly, specializing in audiobook and multimedia editions of the work of the classic pre-war pulp writers. This podcast is covered under Creative Commons license type CC by SA 4.0. Basically, that means you can do anything you want with the content. Reprint it, remix it, add to it, songify it, post it on your blog, fire up the old Cessna and skywrite it, whatever you want to do, as long as you A, give me credit for it, and B, whatever you make is also released under a Creative Commons license. But hey, if you need either A or B waived, hit me up, fj@offbeatoregon.com. Don't let my old middle school principal fool you. I actually do play well with others. Our theme music is by the Atlas String Band and was written by Carmen Ficarra. Listen and download more at atlasstringband.com. Questions, critiques, ideas for a future episode, or maybe you'd like to get together and have a cup of coffee or a pint of Hammerhead and talk history, email me at fj@offbeatoregon.com. Episodes of Offbeat Oregon History are uploaded around 6 a.m. every weekday, so the next one will be on your device and ready to go before you know it. And the next one will be a Friday episode, which means it'll be brand new. So until then, go out and fill up the rest of the day with good stuff. Bye now.